has landed in jail. Look out, boys, they come down fast. Baby addiction of the wicked class. In your heart or in your home, never have to be alone. Woman, doors and wild attack, anything to catch up with.
Welcome to another edition of Stark Raven here on Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM. On Stark Raven, we delve into issues of imprisonment and criminalization, and we do air the first three Mondays of each month from 7 till 8 p.m. here on 102.7 FM, and our podcast is available anytime at prisonjustice.ca. I'm Emily Aspinwall, and I'm here tonight with Marge Lamb and operator Louise Croft. In the next hour, we bring you a World AIDS Day special. Prisoners are organizing for health and harm reduction on the inside. In a couple of minutes, we'll be talking to an ex-prisoner about his work and his perspectives on the fight against HIV and hepatitis C transmission inside Canadian prisons. And Stockwell Day has just announced that the Safer Tattooing project in prisons is going to be scrapped. We'll be talking more about that and the reaction from prisoners and politicians in the second half of the show. And in honor of World AIDS Day, we're going to bring you some music from the Red Hot series. These are albums produced to raise awareness and funds to fight AIDS worldwide. So we'll finish the show off with local community events and announcements. And so stay tuned to Stark Raven for our World AIDS Day special. In the next hour here on Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM. And we're going to start off with a song from the Red Hot and Rio CD. And this track is Kazua and Bebel Gilberto and Preciso Dizer Que Te Amo. Co-op Radio, this is Stark Raven 102.7 FM.
Agora eu queria apresentar uma música de autoria de Dé, Bebel e Cazuza, chamada Eu Preciso Dizer Que Eu Te Amo. Bebel vai começar a cantar agora. Por favor, não faça barulho no ambiente. Muito obrigado.
Maestro.
Maestro, Deco.
Vai.
Vai, sapo. Pato.
Besteiras, tanta coisa incomum, deixando escapar segredos. Eu não sei que hora dizer, me dá um medo. Que medo é que eu preciso dizer que eu te amo. te ganhar ou perder, sem engano.
É, eu preciso dizer que eu te amo tanto. E até o tempo passa arrastado, só pra eu ficar do teu lado. Você me chora dores de outro amor, se abre e acaba comigo. E nessa novela eu não quero ser teu amigo. É que eu preciso dizer que eu te amo, te ganhar ou perder, se engano. É,
eu preciso dizer que eu te amo tanto. Eu já não sei se eu tô misturando.
Ah, eu perco o sono, lembrando em cada riso teu qualquer bandeira. Fechando e abrindo a geladeira a noite inteira.
É que eu preciso dizer que eu te amo, te ganhar ou perder, sem engano.
É, eu preciso dizer que eu te amo tanto. Quando a gente conversa, contando casos, besteiras, tanta coisa em passa arrastado, só pra eu ficar do teu lado. Você chora dores de outro amor, se abre e acaba comigo. E nessa novela, baby, eu não quero ser teu amigo, não, não.
É que eu preciso dizer que eu te amo, te ganhar ou perder, sem engano.
É, eu preciso dizer que eu te amo.
And that track was off Red Hot and Rio, and the song is called Preciso Dizer Que Te Amo, and it's the two artists that you were listening to sing that gorgeous song, Casusa and Bebel Gilberto. And Casusa, with his group Barro Vermejo, was the most influential songwriter of the first generation of rock brasileiro bands to emerge during the 80s. His music spoke directly about love and what was really going on in Brazilian society. After 5 hugely successful solo albums, Casusa died of AIDS on July 7th, 1990, leaving behind millions of heartbroken fans and friends. This home recording was done on the day Casusa, Bebel Gilberto, and Day wrote Preciso Dizer Que Te Amo, I Must Say That I Love You. This song later became a national hit for Marina Lima.
You're listening to Stark Raven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, and we are your local prison radio show, and we're doing a focus here for World AIDS Day. People in prison are 30 times more likely to be infected with hepatitis C than people on the outside, and almost 10 times more likely to be infected with HIV. In response to these staggering infection rates, expert committees have been formed, research has been compiled, numerous reports written, recommendations made, all reaching virtually the same conclusion. Harm reduction initiatives are needed on the inside. At the top of the list is a needle exchange program. But a combination of lack of political will and ideological motivations mean that year after year, little action is taken. Prisoners experience firsthand the effects of this lack of action. Jim Motherall was a prisoner who worked with other prisoners to take action to prevent the spread of HIV and hepatitis C. When inside, Jim was the chairperson of the Stony Mountain Penitentiary Health Awareness Group at Stony Mountain Medium Security Prison just outside Winnipeg. The group provided health education to new prisoners and worked to implement harm reduction measures inside. Jim is now on the outside, where he's continuing his work advocating for prisoners' rights and prisoners' health. Jim joins us on the phone from Winnipeg. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
How did you get involved in harm reduction work on the inside?
That began in 1985. One of the prisoners was diagnosed with HIV and committed suicide. He knew very little about the virus, and it was a pretty scary thing in 1995. That was basically when it first started to hit the prison system. And he didn't want to face what we knew at that time about HIV, so it was decided that we needed to form a group that would educate itself about the virus and act as a support for other prisoners and advocacy for them.
So that's when you got involved in the Stony Mountain Penitentiary Health Awareness Group?
Yes, yes it is.
And what kind of things did the group do?
Well, we held meetings where we brought in guest speakers on various illnesses that could affect the prison population. We dealt with HIV, with Hep C, tuberculosis, all sorts of illnesses. We dealt with stress. We started an education program that was unofficial at first, where we would take all the newcomers and we would go over HIV with them and hepatitis and tuberculosis, stress, suicide awareness and things like that to prepare them for their time in Stony Mountain.
And later,
CSC developed that same program and called it theirs.
Oh. I was just going to ask you what the reaction of the prison authorities were to some of your work.
Well, when we got political, we really weren't appreciated all that much when we started getting into the harm reduction and calling for more harm reduction methods, especially with needle exchange. That seemed to be the one that created the most tension.
So what kind of harm reduction measures currently exist inside it, and what changes have you seen over the years with those harm reduction measures?
Well, I don't know that we can... it's hard to measure the changes or whether or not they've been effective. I mean, we have high rates of HIV in prison, but what came in were condoms and bleach. And bleach, we thought in the beginning when it came in, would kill the HIV virus and the Hep C virus if the existing syringes were cleaned properly. But there have since been studies that say that the strength of bleach used there wouldn't kill the Hep C virus. So consequently, you see the Hep C numbers rise and at a much higher rate than the HIV numbers. So bleach is good for HIV and has probably kept that down, but it hasn't done much for the Hep C virus. And we need to understand that when I went to Stony Mountain in 1985, the drug of choice was marijuana, grass, and that didn't cause any viruses. But when Corrections, in its attempt to stop drugs from coming in or catch those who are using drugs, brought in the random urinalysis testing, prisoners switched from smoking grass or weed to the harder drugs because they were in and out of the system much quicker and harder to detect, which involved the use of syringes in some cases. So actually the problem has helped to be created by Corrections attempt to stop drugs in the first place.
Yeah, I was going to ask, a lot of the issues related to the spread of HIV relate to the policies of the Correctional Service of Canada around drug use. And you mentioned a little bit there, but can you tell us more about how they deal with drugs on the inside and how that impacts attempts to fight the transmission of HIV and hepatitis C?
If I'm understanding the question, how they deal about drugs inside?
Yeah, well, their policies around drugs and how that connects to the rates of transmission of HIV and hepatitis C.
Okay, well, their policy is a punishment. Punishment is the way to deal with addiction. Punishment is the way to deal with drugs. And because of that, you have probably maybe at the most around 10 syringes in the institution at any time because they have to be smuggled in. With those 10 syringes, you could have as many and have had as many as 20 users on one syringe. So the syringe doesn't last that long. But consider that if one of those users has HIV or Hep C, what's going to happen to the others who use it? Their risk of contracting it increases. And also bear in mind that HIV and hepatitis C are blood-to-blood. They're transmitted blood-to-blood. Prison is sometimes a violent environment where fights occur. So HIV and Hep C can be spread that way as well. Everyone is at risk because of a punishment policy. We don't have a very good medical model in prisons at all to deal with this issue. When I left Stony Mountain, the method for somebody who was addicted to get help was to go to his parole officer, admit that he was a drug user, and ask for help. The parole officer would immediately have to inform security, who would come and give him a urinalysis. Well, if he just admitted to doing drugs, clearly he's going to be dirty in a urinalysis. And when that happens, then he would be charged for having used drugs and would suffer consequences like losing visits with his family or fines or, you know, time locked up in dissociation. So there really wasn't much incentive for people to come forward and ask for help.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It doesn't sound very encouraging to try and seek any help if you're looking for it. And you mentioned the controversy of talking about needle exchange programs. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about why you see those as necessary inside prisons.
Well, if there were a needle exchange program, then we could eliminate the sharing of syringes, because all those who use would have clean syringes to use. Now, the only way that would work, of course, is if all prisoners were to have a clean syringe in their cell. Now, if syringes were legal, these syringes would be displayed in the open when officers do their cell searches, which eliminates the risk that a guard is going to be stuck with a dirty needle when he does a search. And it eliminates the idea that they can trap who's doing drugs, because every prisoner would have a clean syringe. Now, the argument against that, of course, is that some guards are saying that syringes could be used as weapons. If they were going to be used as weapons, they would be more likely to use the infected ones now, not clean ones later. I mean, stick a guard with a clean needle, you're just going to get your butt kicked. And that doesn't seem like make much sense. When bleach came in, they said that bleach would be used as weapons and thrown in guards' eyes. As far as I know, there's yet to be an example where bleach has ever been thrown in a guard's eyes. Prisoners know what's good for them, and they're not going to abuse it. So I would see needle exchange being done that way and brought in that way. And also the other argument is that if they allow needle exchange, they're condoning the use of drugs. And that dog don't hunt. They would still charge people for bringing drugs in. They would still charge prisoners they caught using drugs or in a condition other than normal. So their arguments against needle exchange are, as far as I'm concerned, invalid and absolutely ridiculous. Needle exchange would decrease the infection rate going up. It would definitely decrease it. And for every one that they stop, look at the cost savings. Works out to about $12,000 a month per prisoner who has it and has to be treated. Per year, I'm sorry.
And there has been a lot of reports and evidence produced as to the effectiveness of needle exchange programs, and they exist in other countries, as well as the effectiveness of other harm reduction programs. And you talked a little bit about the resistance from some guards and people's concern about needles being used as a weapon. But why do you think the CSC's not instituted these programs if the evidence is there?
Well, let's look at what they would have to do first. They would have to admit that they can't stop drugs from coming into the prison. And they can't. And they know they can't. But they can't allow the public to know that. Or they can't allow the public to believe that. And it would take a politician to stand up and take an unpopular stand publicly, because corrections and the media and the government have gone to such lengths to villainize prisoners that for a politician to stand up now and say, you know what, we need to do this. Stockwell Bay just took safer tattooing out of prisons because he's following party policy, not because it was a smart decision. He took a harm reduction out, which means that because the harm reduction has been taken out, it runs the risk again that HIV and hepatitis C are going to rise. And the more they rise, the more danger the community is in, because most of the prisoners get out, and a lot of them won't know they have Hep C or HIV.
Yeah, I was reading a lot of opinions on online today about Stockwell Day's decision, and there was a lot of people who just really simplify it in that vein of saying, well, they should just stop the drugs going into the prison, or, you know, they shouldn't have them anyways, or if you don't want to get HIV, then don't use a dirty needle, or stuff like that. So, you know, this opinion is very widespread in our society, I think.
It's laughable. And it's those opinions are out there because the public is not aware of how prison functions. An addiction is an addiction. It controls your life until you're able to face it and break it, and that is not an easy thing to do, and the system isn't set up to help you to do that. So these guys are in there with addictions. There's no medical model in there that I'm aware of. It's all punishment. And we have a government that wants to make punishment more severe. You know, in over 160 years of prisons in this country, punishment hasn't solved the problem, but we still don't learn. And we don't take the time to learn. I wish that the public would actually question the system instead of just listening to it. Instead of just believing that it's always right, question it, because it is not protecting them, it is hurting them.
And so, what is it like for prisoners to be HIV positive while inside? Can you tell us a little bit more about their experiences?
Well, it's a hopeless situation because prison is not a good place to be sick. I know that in some cases, prisoners will be taken out to the community to a specialist. And a lot of times a specialist will order Nabilone for them. Now, Nabilone it contains THC, which is one of the ingredients in marijuana. And it is designed to increase their appetite because they don't have an appetite with HIV and they need to eat to maintain strength and weight. So specialists are recommending Nabilone, which has the THC content. And the institution doctor at Stony was overruling them and not giving them the Nabilone. So, I mean, you're in a situation where you've got a specialist who specializes in this area recommending one course of treatment and an institution doctor denying it because he doesn't want to pass out narcotics within the prison, and Nabilone is a narcotic. But at the same time, he's passing out methadone. That's a narcotic too. Now, methadone is needed. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you should take methadone out, but I mean, if you're going to not give Nabilone because it's a narcotic, how can you justify that by saying you're not going to give out narcotics when you're giving out methadone?
And what's the stigma like inside being HIV positive?
Well, the health awareness group and the education program went a long way to changing stigma. When we first started, the idea was that the belief among a lot of prisoners was that those with HIV or Hep C should be in a part of the prison all by themselves so that they're isolated from the rest of the population. That's changed. Prisoners are more accepting of the fact that other prisoners have HIV and Hep C now than they were before because of education. Because they know that they have to, you know, behave in ways that would bring about the virus. The only thing that you know, I mean, fighting is an irresponsible behavior according to our standards, right? So if you get into a fight, and you get into a fight with somebody with HIV or Hep C, then you run the risk of getting it. But once education is put out there, people can make informed decisions about how they're going to behave.
So what did you learn from your work with the health awareness group? What kinds of things do you feel you gained from that work?
Well, I can tell you, it woke me up. I learned that there was a whole world outside of the little world I was living in. I learned that there's a lot more suffering going on than I ever recognized. It woke me up. And it gave me a reason to get up in the morning. Because it was something to do. It was something that had to be addressed. The prison system is basically killing those men by not doing what they need to do. If somebody came out of prison knowing that they had HIV, or anybody on the street knowing that they had HIV, willingly passed it on to other people, they would be criminally charged and locked up, and rightfully so. So maybe our elected officials and corrections need to be charged for not doing everything they have at their disposal to stop the spread.
How have you found it working on these issues now that you're on the outside? What kind of perspective do you have now?
I am totally disgusted with our prison system and the way it deals with it. I am amazed at how little the public knows about the prison system. I'm amazed at how little they know about what's coming down the road as this crosses boundaries from the prison to the community. I'm amazed that they haven't figured out that when prisoners get out, health care costs are borne by the federal government and the provincial government, and that if Stockwell Day thinks he's saving $700,000 by taking out safer tattooing programs, they're in for a rude awakening when they start to get the health care costs down the road. $700,000 will seem like peanuts. And he's putting the communities at risk and prisoners.
What has sustained you to continue this work while on the inside and now outside prison?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that.
What has sustained you? What keeps you going to continue this work? I mean, you worked on this for a long time on the inside, and now you're on the outside still speaking out and working on these issues.
Well, one of the reasons, Emily, is that someone I love and I'm close to may end up with HIV or Hep C because the system didn't do what it's supposed to do. And I wouldn't want to be the one looking into a parent's eyes who have a teenage daughter or a young adult daughter who meets a prisoner coming out. I mean, they don't come out with prisoner tattooed across their forehead. You know, and they may not know that they have HIV or Hep C and form a relationship that becomes sexual at some point and passes it on. I mean, HIV is a sexually transmitted disease. I mean, I wonder if Stockwell Day or Harper want to look into the eyes of a parent when they could have done something about it and didn't.
Well,
you know, I don't want to become a community that waits until it's too late to react to HIV and Hep C. Look what's happened to nations that did.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us this evening, Jim.
Thank you for having me.
We have been speaking with Jim Motherall. He's an ex-prisoner, and when he was in Stony Mountain Prison, he was the chairperson of the Health Awareness Group, and the group lobbied for harm reduction initiatives and did peer education around HIV, hepatitis C, and other health issues. Jim's now on the outside, where he continues his work advocating for prisoners. You're listening to Stark Raven here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. We're going to go now to a track off of the Red Hot and Riot CD.
Let's start. What I have come into the room to do.
Wrongdoers who have done the wrong unto you.
Ooh, you supposed to
to serve and protect, but what about who? Be inspecting and checking you, is it man of God's rules? Village wrecking with evidence, still the planet's all fools. So I'm beckoning and reckon we need to manage y'all. You know the rules. This is the Kalakutaku.
Many know and see the beast with donation, taking advantage of his post and station. Turn peacekeeping into an aggressive operation. Said you need to take a permanent vacation.
Many shouldn't even have chosen this occupation. Devils pose as angels, walk the beat faking. Take away my earth like they was gon' waste it. Took it to the head like head stuck to they stand. Working for the devil in hell, they hate agents. Someone check the wiring, it's glitches in the matrix.
The people give to you your power, your gun, your shield, your hours. Citizens are not to be abused.
And everything they tell you may not really be the truth.
They use a gun today, back in the day they use a goose. So many problems in the world today. How should not be the thing causing people dismay? We got
terror, corruption, guns, AIDS.
Now I gotta dodge public servants with 12 gauges. Otherwise they gon' lock me up in a cage. Like I'm some wild animal treated like a slave.
Pulling they holes and billing they hate. Speech freedom, supposedly just watch what you say. Is the truth or hurt them even though the truth ain't hate? Retaliation with the vengeance on this holy state. Not up in your theater, see it all pop in real life. Corrupt invading your city, beat your black and blue, right? Wanna inform the city, the beast is on the move, right? Need to protect yourself when it's either them or you. Fire.
Give you your power, your gun, your shield, your salary. Represent the truth. Civilians and citizens are not to be abused.
And everything they tell us really may not be the truth. They use a gun today, back in the day they use a noose.
And that track, we listened to a couple tracks actually off of Red Hot and Riot. The first one was Fela Mentality, and the second one was Kalakuta Show with Mixmaster Mike Latif and the Gift of Gab, and it was written by Fela Annie Kulapo Kuti. I know him as Fela Kuti. I never learned his middle name. And Fela Kuti was one of the most important West African musicians of the past 50 years. In the early 1970s, he created a form of powerful rhythmic music called Afrobeat by combining indigenous Nigerian rhythms and melodies with American funk and free jazz. But he was more than just an innovative musician. He was also a visionary, a man who saw the political corruption around him and the injustices of post-colonial Africa, and wrote about them in a way that spoke directly to the everyday people he sought to defend. He was so successful as a musician and spiritual leader that he almost single-handedly represented the political opposition to those condemned in his lyrics, the police, the army, big business, and religious organizations. His popularity spread across Africa like wildfire, bringing him into almost constant conflict with the authorities. He was arrested more than 200 times, receiving many savage beatings and incarcerations in the process. But each time, he would emerge more fiery and outspoken than before, continuing to record and speak out about the things he cared about: great music, women, and the right of African people to control their own destiny, free of exploitative foreign influences and corrupt local politicians. Finally, in 1997, a force brought him down that is even more powerful and insidious than the system he railed against: AIDS, a disease that has scourged the entire world, but nowhere as much or as cruelly as in Africa. This album is a tribute to the great songs Fela wrote, the infectious grooves he and his band laid down, and to the man himself who fearlessly put his life online on a daily basis for more than 30 years. It combined contemporary musicians from across the African diaspora, urban America, Brazil, Cuba, Europe, and West Africa, including his son Femi Kuti and drummer Tony Allen, along with a cross-section of some of the best and most creative musicians in the world. And hopefully the combinations are not just musical, but also symbolic of how people need to work together to achieve the positive life force embodied in Fela's music and spirit. It's a really great album. You guys should check it out.
Long time, even out in the bright sunshine, in a lifetime of springtime. I fall into your arms and my heart pumping on like a bubbling dub track, like a garlicky hot to the lip smack. I did some contemplation before we got down to this consecration. Or maybe, baby, something in your kiss said it was an impetus for me to rethink this. If I love you, then I better get tested, make sure we are protected. I walk through the park just like a question mark. Hark, I hear my memory bark in the back of my brain, making me insane like cocaine. But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? Or how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Dawned on me, it seemed to me that this is unusual scenery. This red light greenery made me feel kinda dreamery, thinking how I used to be. Arrive at the clinic and walk through the front door. I take a nervous number, then I'm thinking some more about all the times that I neglected, making sure that I was protected. They took my blood with an anonymous number. 2 weeks waiting, one should've done this a long time ago. A lot of excuses why I couldn't go. I know these things and these things I must know, but it's better to know than to not know. But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? Or how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Who they slept with. I think about life and immortality. What's the first thing I do if I'm HIV? I have a cry and tell my mother. Get on the phone, call my past lovers. I never thought about infecting another. The times that I said, don't bother. Was it really all that magic? The times I didn't use a prophylactic. Will my whole life have to change? Will my whole life remain the same? Sometimes it makes me want to shout. All these things too hard to think about. A day to laugh, day to cry, a day to live and a day to die. Till I find out, I may wonder, but I'm not gonna live my life 6 feet under. Cause how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm positive? Is it gonna be a negative? But how am I gonna live my life if I'm
That was Michael Franti, and the track was called Positive off his album Home. And now we're going to move into our next interview.
You are listening to Stark Raven here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, and you're listening to a World AIDS Day special. Tattooing has been part of prison culture for decades, but the practice is still illegal inside Canadian prisons. Prisoners wanting tattoos are forced to be resourceful, often using unsterile items such as sewing needles, pieces of old VCR motors, and twist ties to perform tattoos. Unsafe tattooing is one of the reasons why there is an alarmingly high rate of HIV as well as hepatitis C infection inside prison. After years of lobbying from prisoners and community organizations, last year the Correctional Service of Canada finally set up 6 safer tattooing sites. But these sites were only part of a pilot project. And now the sites are sitting idle. And word has just come out of Ottawa that Stockwell Day plans to cancel the program. Here to speak with us more on the future of safer tattooing inside Canadian prisons is Richard Elliott. Richard is the Deputy Director at the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. Welcome to the show, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Stockwell Day has just come out as saying he's planning on canceling this program. What are the details of his announcement?
We don't have a lot of details yet. He issued the announcement earlier today, basically saying that the federal government would not be continuing to support these programs. They were, as you mentioned in your introduction, they were six sites that were introduced on a pilot project basis, and so he's now apparently decided that they will not be continuing them. But what we haven't yet seen is any of the data from the evaluation of these sites that was supposed to have been done. So the minister has gone out there and made this announcement, but it doesn't actually seem that the evaluation results are in.
Yeah, that was my next question. I was just wondering, because we hadn't heard about the evaluation, what is the actual process for looking at the impacts of these safer tattooing sites?
Well, there was a whole evaluation framework that the Correctional Service of Canada had developed, where it was going to measure a number of things to see how the projects were working, whether prisoners were using them, whether the way it was functioning was acceptable to prisoners, whether it was having an impact on reducing the frequency with which prisoners were getting tattoos unsafely using some of the homemade equipment that you mentioned in your introduction. Some of it, no doubt, going to be shared between prisoners. So they were going to measure a number of things, but it seems like the government hasn't even bothered to wait for the evaluation to be completed before going ahead and deciding it's not going to do this. It really seems to me that it's a decision that isn't driven so much by evidence or by a real concern for the health and safety of either prisoners or staff in the prisons, but is probably, or it seems anyway on the face of it, driven much more by a sort of law and order, let's get tough on criminals ideology.
And so this pilot project ended in September, and there hasn't been the official evaluation, but what's the word on how it went from prisoners or other people involved with the program? How did it fare?
Well, we don't have any hard data yet that's been made available publicly. When this pilot project was first launched, we were supportive of it, and we welcomed the initiative by CSC, Correctional Service of Canada. But we did say at the time that it was important that there be significant opportunities for input by both prisoners and community groups that work with prisoners in prisons to make sure that the programs were going to be as effective as possible. There's been some concern that without that kind of input, the full benefit of the programs wouldn't be realized, but clearly the answer to that is not just to cancel the programs, and I doubt very much that that's the motivation behind the minister's decision to cancel the programs. What we'd been saying was, it's good that you have these programs, now make sure that the people who need to use them and benefit from them are actually going to have some input in how they function so that you can really make sure that you deliver on the benefit. It doesn't look like we're going to get that chance now.
And so did you hear any response from guards or prisoners specifically on how it was working for them on the inside?
Well, I think that question is probably best posed to prisoners themselves. I don't have any data at the moment about what prisoners were finding with the sites. That was one of the things that was going to come out in the evaluation. But we know that the sites have been used. How much each site has been used is something that we'd need to see the final numbers for from the evaluation. But clearly every time one of those safer tattooing rooms was used, that was one less instance in which someone was getting a tattoo using some sort of homemade equipment and possibly equipment that hadn't been properly cleaned.
So is this evaluation still going to happen even though they've canceled the program, or is it just going to cut short?
That we don't know. The announcement just came out today. I would assume that much of the information has been gathered within Correctional Service of Canada for the purposes of that evaluation that was planned, but I don't know at this stage whether they will actually complete their assessment and their analysis of that information and ever make it public. Certainly, in our view, that is information that should be made public. This was an important initiative, and it certainly seems to us that that kind of evidence should actually be made public in order to inform what the policy in the future is going to be. And we certainly hope that the government's going to reconsider this.
For the past decade, there's been all kinds of reports and different committees meeting at community and government levels to recommend safer tattooing sites. Why are these so important, and what's going to happen now with tattooing heading fully back underground inside?
Well, we know from the evidence that has been gathered over the years, as you mentioned, that there is a significant percentage of prisoners who do get tattoos inside prisons. We do know tattooing's been happening underground without the right kind of equipment to do it, and without sterile equipment necessarily to do it. So now that this option has been shut down, at least in those places where it was running, I think the health consequences for prisoners are pretty predictable, unfortunately.
And so for people concerned with this decision, both prisoners and the concerned public, is there any way they can respond or something they can do to try and encourage the government to look at the health of prisoners?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that people can do. The first, I think, is that people should actually make their views known directly to Minister Day. I think they should also make their views known to their own Member of Parliament. And then I think they should also make their views known in their community generally, for example, through some sort of letter to the editor or an opinion piece in their local newspaper. And I think it's really important to point out three things about this. There's at least three ways in which this decision by the government is entirely irresponsible. It's irresponsible when it comes to the human rights of prisoners, because we sentence people to prison to do time in prison, but they retain all of their other rights except those that are necessarily limited by the fact that they're in prison. So we don't sentence them to be deprived of access to sterile tattooing equipment. The second thing is it's totally irresponsible when it comes to public health. The health of prisoners is certainly part and parcel of the health of our communities overall. Prisoners are part of our communities. Prisoners go back into our communities. So denying HIV prevention tools like clean tattooing equipment to prisoners doesn't make sense from a public health perspective. And finally, for those who think that this is somehow a saving of taxpayers' money, I think it's important to make the point that this is actually fiscally irresponsible on the part of this government that professes to have such a concern for the use of taxpayer dollars. This is actually a cost-effective measure if these sites actually prevent even just 4 or 5 cases of HIV or hepatitis C infection in each site, then they've paid for themselves already, given the cost of treating people with those diseases versus actually spending some money wisely investing in prevention in the first place.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us this evening about the safer tattooing sites.
My pleasure. Thanks for covering the issue.
We have been speaking with Richard Elliott. He's with the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network, and the Safer Tattooing pilot project has just been canceled by Public Safety Minister Stockwell Day. To find out more information, you can check out the website of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. It's aidslaw.ca. You can also find an archived Starkraven interview with Glenn Betteridge of the Legal Network on safer tattooing at www.prisonjustice.ca. It's time now for some brief news from Starkraven.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper has announced plans to reform the bail process. Harper met with Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty and Toronto Mayor David Miller on November 23rd. They have agreed to put forward a bail reform package that would see people charged with serious crimes show why they should be out of jail. Harper says that almost 1,000 crimes involving firearms or restricted weapons have been committed in Toronto this year. He said that nearly 40% of those crimes were committed by someone on bail, parole, or on temporary absence of probation. The current bail process involves the Crown Prosecutor arguing why a suspect should remain in jail before trial.
The Auditor General has revealed that Canada's former Ombudsman for Prisoners skipped work on most days. Auditor General Sheila Fraser has released a report on the practices of former correctional investigator Ron Stewart. Stewart was Ombudsman for the federal prisoners for 26 years until 2003. Fraser's report reveals that Stewart missed work on 319 days in the last 5 years of his career, but he still billed the government for that time. The former Ombudsman collected $325,000 in improper or questionable salary, vacation pay, and expenses. Before becoming the correctional investigator, Stewart was a CFL football star with the Ottawa Rough Riders. The Auditor General reports that Stewart charged the government for 5 trips to cities hosting Grey Cup games. The report says the travel and hospitality charged for these trips did not relate to Stewart's work. Sheila Fraser has referred Stewart's file to the RCMP for further investigation. And that's the end of the news here on Stark Raven. We'll be back in a couple moments with some community announcements. You are listening to Stark Raven here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. You've been listening to our World AIDS Day special, and we're just going to finish off the show with some calendar announcements.
Rhymes and Resistance, an evening of hip-hop, poetry, music, comedy, spoken word, and song. A fundraiser to support the word of no, the work, and the words, I guess, of No One Is Illegal, and to celebrate our four-year anniversary, join us. Saturday, December 9th, it's a Saturday, 7 p.m. at Gallery Gachet, 88 East Cordova. Suggested donation, $10. Featuring local artists, Beto, Carlos Seo, DJ Ariel, Kat Norris, Marcus Youssef, Roop and Nadia, Secret Trial 5, Cetere, Usama, Ahmad. They're all local celebrities, really. For more information, email noii-van@resist.ca. Or call 778-552-2099.
This Wednesday, December 6th, there is a Frank Paul Memorial Rally, 2:30 at the Main Street SkyTrain station in Vancouver. At 3 p.m., it'll be at the 377 East 2nd Avenue. That's the alley behind the Detox Center. So imagine they'll be moving from the SkyTrain to behind the Detox. It's a rally for Frank Paul and all Aboriginal people who've been maltreated or have died in police custody. Bring regalia, signs, drums, rattles, and banners. It's organized by the Indigenous Action Movement and the Anti-Poverty Committee. For more information, check out apc.resist.ca.
Homes Now, Sunday, December 10th, 2 p.m. at Pigeon Park, which is on the corner of Carroll and Hastings. December 10th is the International Human Rights Day. The Anti-Poverty Committee is inviting people to join them as they take over a provincially owned building to demand the construction of social housing. They are requesting donations of blankets, sleeping bags, building material, warm clothing, food, coffee, as well as financial donations. You can drop off any donations at the APC office located at 327 Carroll Street. Open hours are Tuesday to Friday from 2 to 6 p.m. You can call them for more info at 604-682-3276 and check their website at apc.resist.ca.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you're interested in keeping in touch with Stark Raven, you can join our fabulous email list. We send out a monthly email with information about our upcoming shows, links to audio on our podcast, and a digest of our recent news. So just email us at stark-raven@coopradio.org, or you can give us a call after the show, 684-7561. You can also call us to give us any feedback or any ideas about the show. And if you missed an episode of Stark Raven, you can catch the podcast, download it onto your computer. Yes, you can check that out at prisonjustice.ca. Next week, Monday, 7 p.m., we'll be here with a feature on the 2007 political prisoner calendar, prison news, and more. So coming up next is Think Indian, followed by Pajvak and Blues in the Dark. So enjoy the rest of your evening tuning into Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Good night from Stark Raven.
One, two.
I was stabbed by Satan on the day that I was born. I was promised loving, but instead I was torn. La la la, la la la, my heart bled. La la la, la la la, my eyes shed tears.
A poor black ghetto child, he can't shoot and he can't go run a mile. There's no school. Running wild, the police and the courts wanna run him out. He's so po and the po-po hate him all. He ain't seen his daddy since back in 84. But oh well, so it be, now he's in jail. His mother's stressing just to get him out on bail. Now sing it out.
I was stabbed by Satan on the day that I was born. I was promised loving, but instead I was torn. La la la,
yeah.
La la la.
Stop. The police with the big glocks pull them out. They say freeze, but there's only one coming out. There's two dead with a legal gun to his head. It's stupid, he should have played ball instead. I sing it out.
I was stabbed by Satan on the day that I was born. I was promised love, but instead I was torn. La la la,
yeah.
La la la,
yeah.
My heart bled.
Rap song ever sung. My verses will be curses to the rich and all sorts of authority will cease to exist. My daughters will be free of wars and my honor your fists will raise in the air. In the silence of revolution, my face will appear like the vision of a prisoner with his last bid. This song is a poem and the whole poem is a tear dropped in your ear.
I was stabbed by Satan on the day that I was born. I was promised loving, but instead I la la la,
yeah.
La la la,
yeah.
My heart bled.
My heart bled fear.
La la la,
yeah.
La la la,
yeah.
My eyes shed tears. I was stabbed by Satan on the day that I was born. I was promised
loving,
but instead I was torn. La la la,
yeah.
La la la,
yeah.
My heart bled.
Kids cry when they're born. Ever ask yourself that? I mean, there's no scientific reason explaining that. Well, it is said Satan stabs a child at birth as an introduction to pain. You know, welcome to the world, right?